Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, voting in the 2020 presidential election. Last March, as the pandemic had just taken hold on the country, I spoke with elections law professor Edward Foley. He warned back then that the country must begin preparing for the general election, which was sure to be very different from other years. Now that we're just a few weeks away from November 3rd, I invited Professor Foley back. I talked with him about how Americans are voting, from mail-in ballots to early voting, and the flurry of election litigation that's already making its way through the courts. Edward Foley is professor and director of the Election Law Program at Ohio State University. We spoke Tuesday morning. Professor Foley, we are 3 weeks away from the election, but there are hundreds of lawsuits moving through the courts related to the rules of who can vote, how ballots can be cast, and by when they must be counted. Give us kind of an overview of what's happening here.
Sure, and it's great to be with you, Diane, as always.
Thank you.
You know, this is an unprecedented year in terms of the explosion of litigation. We always see lots of lawsuits around the presidential elections, or at least we've had seen that ever since 2000. But this year, the litigation's arms race, if you will, has reached unprecedented proportions. And I think, you know, after this year, when the dust settles and we can kind of look back, we'll have to figure out how did this happen, because the Supreme Court has said it wants to make the litigation around the voting process less chaotic, more orderly, so that it's not disruptive to voters and it's not disruptive to poll workers or local officials. You know, the voting process has become contentious. And, you know, I want a voting system that allows everybody who's eligible to vote and to vote easily, and then to have a system that counts votes fairly and with integrity. But all of the debates about how best to do that should occur well in advance of the dates where you actually begin the process itself. Because once it's underway, if you're changing the rules in the middle of the election, it's very destabilizing. It's very disconcerting for the public trying to think, is the system able to work? And so it is quite surprising, actually, just how much this kind of arms race has kind of spun out of control, if you will. And despite the desire to avoid what we're now witnessing, it has yet happened anyway.
I understand there are some 260 lawsuits out there, including, I mean, I don't know if this is going to become a lawsuit, but I gather the Republican Party is putting out fake ballot boxes in California. I mean, maybe that's going to be the newest lawsuit as of today.
Probably. I mean, you can't avoid litigation completely. And when new developments happen, there has to be the possibility of seeking a remedy. I mean, think of problems that occur at particular polling places on election day. They don't open on time. Then sometimes you have to, in an emergency, go to court to have extended the polling hours. Again, you'd like to avoid that if you can, but some things are unavoidable. What I think is more worrisome are lawsuits that are happening later in the process than necessary. I mean, some of this litigation is inevitably because of the pandemic, and the pandemic was going to stress, the system. We've talked about that before, and it was going to be this huge logistical challenge of how do we do voting that's safe for everybody and gives opportunity for everybody in the midst of the pandemic. But the way in which the pandemic affects the voting process is different now. You know, in March and April, when the pandemic first arrived, it was an inevitable scramble. and it was to stabilize it of necessity. We've had some months to imagine how the pandemic would affect the November election. And some of the litigation that's happening now, you know, I think could have been anticipated in May, June, or July, not to have quite as much instability now. Now, that's not the California example. That's a different thing where that's a new development. But some of the other lawsuits feel to me, at any rate, like they're issues that were on the horizon, you know, back in the spring.
Give me an example.
Well, for example, in Arizona, there's a case about extending the voter registration deadline. You know, every state has different rules about what's the last date for registering to vote. Some states are very generous and have something called Election Day registration, where you can actually go to the polls on Election Day and register at the same time. You and I might like that as a matter of policy, but in our system, we allow states some degree of choice. There is a national baseline on that, meaning that the National Voter Registration Act from the 1990s, sometimes called the Motor Voter Law, does not allow states to be too onerous with respect to voter registration deadlines. But there is some option. And some states, like Arizona, have had, you know, specific deadlines that were permissible under that federal law. But the issue that's emerged is that the pandemic is making it harder to register to vote, and therefore there should be a judicial adjustment of that deadline. Now, in principle, I can understand the strength of that argument, but that's an argument, at least seems to me, that was anticipated during the lockdown last spring. We knew that the conditions that would make it difficult to leave one's house and difficult to register to vote existed as soon as we saw the pandemic affecting the primaries. And yet the injunction that came from the federal court to change the voter registration deadline was a week or so ago, which feels, again, I mean, you know, maybe there's, you always look at the briefs and look at all the arguments on both sides, so I don't want to prejudge a case that I'm not deeply involved in. It just, you know, the first impression is that's a case that seems as an example of one where the question that I would ask, well, wasn't that lawsuit filed, you know, months ago as opposed to more recently?
And in Philadelphia, a case filed by the Trump campaign in Pennsylvania blocking the use of drop boxes. Can you talk about that one?
Yes. Yeah, so the issue of drop boxes has been much in litigation in several states, Texas, Ohio, Pennsylvania as well. Again, I'm, as a someone who studies election laws, I'm a big fan of drop boxes as an option. You know, again, they need to be safe and secure. They need to be the government's own drop boxes, not private parties saying we're going to do an alternative. That's not appropriate. But if the local boards of elections, the Secretary of State has secure drop boxes, that's, I think, a very good thing because it means there's a way to return a ballot that you voted home without relying on the Postal Service. And we've seen this year significant questions about the Postal Service. So I wish a robust system of drop boxes had been put in place in many, many states around the country. Again, this can get very technical state to state. You know, the Ohio Secretary of State has claimed that the specific provisions of local law prohibit more than one drop box per county. I think that's debatable. There's been litigation over that. You know, something like that has also gone on in Pennsylvania. The Trump campaign, as I understand it, lost that lawsuit. At least at the trial level. And it's hard to, as you say, there's at least 200 lawsuits. And so some of these may already be moving up on appeal. So I don't know that we've heard the last word on even that particular issue in that state. And speaking of Pennsylvania, if I might, as we're talking today, I think particular focus is on a case from Pennsylvania that's sitting at the U.S. Supreme Court and has been there for some days now. This is not about drop boxes specifically, but it's about the timing of return of vote by mail or absentee ballots. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court had granted a 3 additional days beyond what the state law says in terms of when their voter must return those ballots by. Pennsylvania statutory law, like the statutes in a bunch of other states, say that it has to be returned by Election Day itself. And again, because of pandemic-related conditions, the state Supreme Court said, well, we think 3 extra days is necessary. And then there's a debate about postmarks and what if the postmarks aren't on those ballots. I think the whatever the U.S. Supreme Court decides in that pending Pennsylvania case will be significant, not just for Pennsylvania and not just for that particular issue, but might be a signal about the nature of all of this litigation and how the lower court should have as their general posture what to think about these cases. That's just a guess on my part, but I'm looking closely at that particular case.
So you're suggesting that that will go to the highest Supreme Court in the land. It's already there and waiting.
Correct. It's on a, what's called an emergency stay application. There are a couple of them been filed on behalf of the Republican Party of Pennsylvania, and then also some members of the state legislature who are Republican who want the statutory rules to apply as opposed to what the state Supreme Court did. And yes, so that is in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, at least in this emergency posture. And because it's an emergency application, one would think that the court would rule fairly quickly. Some listeners may be aware that there have been emergency petitions of this nature from Montana, from South Carolina, that were handled very quickly by the U.S. Supreme Court. This one, it's taking a little bit longer. Part of that is there isn't quite the absolute necessity because we're talking about what happens with respect to the November 3rd deadline and whether there's 3 more days. That's not quite the same as are Dropbox is available today and tomorrow, or are witness signatures required on ballots filed today or tomorrow. So the court is probably taking a little bit more time, you know, because they want to do a good job. But it also might signal that it'll be a more significant decision once we get it.
What about North Carolina, where the Republican National Committee wants to make sure that there are witnesses to ballots? I mean, has this been the case in previous elections?
Yes. I mean, I'm not a fan of witness requirements for absentee ballots. I think they're unnecessary and burdensome even when there isn't a pandemic. And I do think they can cause problems. If you recall the Minnesota U.S. Senate election from 2008, this was Al Franken, the comedian, was the challenger to the incumbent Norm Coleman. And Franken ends up winning and becoming senator. But that went to litigation for months. And one of the issues that was in dispute there was a witness requirement that Minnesota had at the time, because it did trip up voters. And then what took it so long in court was that different localities within the state were variable in their enforcement of the same state law, because you can imagine some local officials wanting to do right by their own constituents and their voters say, you know what, this witness requirement is, it just trips up our voters. We know our voters. We know they're valid voters. So we're not going to enforce the witness requirement. Well, but in another county, they say, hey, we got to follow the rules whether we like it or not. And that variability creates an equal protection issue because it's a statewide race. We want to treat all voters equally and fairly. And so that went up and down the judicial process. And as you may remember, it took until July of the following year for Senator Franken actually to be sworn in. So there, I could give you other examples. So yes, there have been these witness requirements in the past. They can cause problems. I completely, personally, as a, again, scholar, sympathetic with the idea that we should suspend these witness requirements in the midst of a pandemic. But this case is another example of one where I think, shouldn't we be litigating this 2 months ago? Not right now. You know, we've known about the pandemic. We've known about these witness requirements. The time to sort this all out was over the summer, not in October.
So time is clearly running out. but many of these issues are yet to be decided. So what are voters in places like North Carolina to believe when they go to cast their votes? Do they have to have a witness, or is that just in certain places? What's the situation?
Yeah, no, this is really hard. This is why these last-minute changes are so problematic, because it's so hard for anybody to keep track of rules that change. I think the best you can say to a voter is if you have internet access, to check your local board of elections, because the whole election community is talking about the idea of trusted sources. There is this risk of disinformation, and even some of it is unfortunately malevolent, trying to trip voters up, which is just horrible in my view. But some of it is innocent mistakes. Voting rights groups that are trying to do right by voters, telling them, here's what we think we know, and yet they may not have the latest information because of changes, or because there's 200 lawsuits, it might be easy to misunderstand exactly where things are. I mean, I have to be honest with you, Diane, I'm not sure that my information is 100% up to date or correct, just because it's so hard to keep track of everything. So what I would say to any voter who is concerned is the local board of elections is supposed to be your own government that's responsible for allowing you to vote. And therefore, they're supposed to be doing their best job to be up to date on their website. The Secretary of State or the chief elections officer in a state should also have pretty reliable information. But I would try to use your local board of elections. Now, for people who don't have internet access, that's obviously hard. This is why this is hard, because if a voter is just trying to figure out what can I do to protect my right to vote, if we're uncertain and say, we don't know where the information is, that could be potentially disenfranchising in and of itself. So I would say, if you can find out what your local board is telling you today, that is as reliable as anything can be. And I do think the good news here is the Supreme Court, in a case from South Carolina just a week or so ago, when they reinstated one of these witness requirements, did acknowledge that voters who relied on the intermediate ruling, in other words, when the lower court had blocked this kind of requirement before it was reinstated, they said that voters who were relying on the rules as they stood when they voted were going to be protected.
And in
the Arizona case I mentioned before, the Secretary of State is trying to get the courts to do that. She's saying, you know, you can't change the rules on us election officials this close to the election. But insofar as the lower court did for a temporary period, protect the voters who relied on that intermediate ruling. Don't disenfranchise them when they thought they could rely on a court order. And I'd like to think that principle of reliance on court orders that were valid at the moment that they were in effect before overturned will protect voters from disenfranchisement. I sure hope so.
More from Professor Edward Foley when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Edward Foley. He's professor and director of the Election Law Program at Ohio State University and author of Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. He's also a contributing columnist for The Washington Post. Professor Foley, the thing I am most concerned about is the president's directive to his followers to show up at polling places and identify themselves as poll watchers without any legal authority to do so. And it strikes me that that could be the height of intimidation.
I share your concern, Diane. I think the president's rhetoric on this point has been very irresponsible. And as a law professor, I tend to want to have a rule of law answer to this. I mean, in other words, again, even if you might wish policies to be somewhat different for next time's election, you really have to abide by the rules as they exist for this year. At least that should be a strong presumption. The other point that I would make, and this is a longstanding principle, is it's imperative to avoid voter suppression or voter intimidation. You know, nothing should happen in our electoral process that, you know, wrongfully prevents people from voting. And we have to stick by that principle. At the same time,
there is no rule allowing these people who are undesignated to walk into voting places to check on voters.
True, but I also think there's a balance here that needs to be struck, which, again, we have to make sure that there's no voter suppression or wrongful intimidation. But transparency of the voting process is also an important democratic value. Both parties have to trust the result. Now, everybody as an individual voter gets a secret ballot. No question about that. But most of the voting process needs to be sufficiently public so that we can all be confident that the rules are being followed and that the procedures are correct. In other words, when you think about recounts, and your mind may go back to Florida of 2000, you know, all of the, and this was a part that Minnesota did successfully in the Al Franken and Norm Coleman recount. They had every disputed ballot was put on a camera that then the internet could look at. And so everybody at home could look at the ovals and say, should this ballot be counted or not? Is the recount board been following it properly? And that gave the people confidence that the electoral process was being fair and that there weren't any moves made. If you may remember in 2018 in Broward County, Florida, in the governor's race and the Senate race that got contested, the local official in Broward County refused to give the two parties access to the information about how the canvassing process and the counting of ballots would go, and was very secretive. That was very problematic and bred distrust. How can you be sure that the process is going correctly? So think about international elections. You know, the Carter Center and others and international observers to make sure that voting is done properly. So the concept of poll watchers is not inherently a bad concept. In fact, as you say, there are rules about signing up to be a designated poll watcher and you need training and so forth. So the idea that we would allow candidates and parties to observe the voting process to make sure that they think it's been done properly is an element of our system and hopefully will allow the losing candidate to acknowledge we have no grounds for complaint because it was all above board. Now, again, they can't demand more access to the process than what the law entitles. But, you know, your listeners may also remember something called the Brooks Brothers riot back in Florida in 2000. That was done in part, in my judgment, by the fact that Miami-Dade, during that Bush versus Gore recount, took the recount behind closed doors. Maybe it was permissible not to do the recount in public under Florida law at the time, but it's not helpful in getting public confidence that the voting process is done properly. So no intimidation, no voter suppression, but hopefully adequate transparency so that everybody can have confidence that the system is working.
Help me to understand the electors in each state. What about those states where there is not a set of electors chosen by the popular vote? What happens next?
So I think the most important point on this topic, I think, is that we have an expectation that the electors who are the members of the Electoral College should be based on the popular vote. Now, the Constitution does allow state legislatures to determine the manner of appointing electors. And going, you know, back to the beginning of American history, some state legislatures chose to appoint electors directly. But, you know, for a long, long time now, the assumption has been that we as citizens should participate in the process. We don't get to vote for president directly, that's true. But because of state law, we as citizens have been given the right to vote for the electors, and we treat that as the functional equivalent for voting. When we look at our ballot, it doesn't have the name of the electors on it. It has the name of the candidates for president. So as a practical matter, we think we're voting for presidents, and that's developed culturally in the norms of our of expectations. And so if the system works properly, it should work according to those expectations, and there shouldn't be really any challenge or doubt to that.
You've written that there are several ways that partisan state legislatures can undermine that process. Help us to understand how.
So here I think it's useful again to remember the Florida 2000 situation, because this line of inquiry was being pursued. This was the circumstance of the hanging chads. And again, remember just how close that election was, 537 vote difference out of 6 million ballots. Political scientists were talking about it as a statistical tie, because the punch card machines that produced these hanging chads were just not that reliable. And so it was a responsible thing for people to say, it's a flip of the coin, really. I mean, you could have an answer, but it's who knows. And so the Florida legislature took it upon itself to begin the process of saying, given just how problematic these hanging chads were, and the Florida legislature, right or wrong, wasn't trusting the judicial process, they said, we're going to just appoint electors directly. We have this power under Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution. It was used historically, and so we're just going to do it ourselves. Now, they didn't actually go all the way down that road, because after the U.S. Supreme Court stopped the recount and Vice President Al Gore accepted it, Florida legislature said, oh, well, we don't need to do that. But that's the model, if you will, or at least the template for what might happen.
Under what circumstances might the Congress get involved? Or do you see the Supreme Court getting involved before the Congress gets involved? What is the step that comes when an election is disputed? What's the next step?
So we could have both. The Supreme Court, again, the circumstances have to align to make a actionable case. You can't just want the court to be involved because you want it, right? And again, the reason why the U.S. Supreme Court did get involved in Bush versus Gore was because it was close, extraordinarily close, and the hanging chads were a genuine problem. So you'd have to replicate something similar. The margin in a battleground state like Pennsylvania or Wisconsin would have to be close, and there would have to be something that would be a basis for litigation. But if it happened, the period between November 3rd, Election Day, and the meeting of the Electoral College on December 14, that's the period where you could get judicial inquiry about the vote counting process. And that could go all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, potentially. If the losing candidate accepted the result of that judicial process the way Al Gore did, that would be the end of the matter, because then the electors would meet on December 14, pursuant to that court order, and there wouldn't, you know, be anything contrary unless the legislature stepped in opposition to the court decision, as we were just talking about. But if what happened on December 14 is not just one set of electors voting for president from a given state, but two rival sets of electors. That's what happened back in Hayes-Tilden back in 1876. Then you could get a dispute going all the way to Congress in January.
I want to ask you about something else you've written about. And you've said that there is a way to avoid another Bush v. Gore, and that is by appointing a three-member panel. Explain what you mean.
Well, the disappointment that many people had with Bush versus Gore is it looked like the court, the justices on the court, were being more partisan than principled, which is upsetting for those of us as lawyers who want the court to act in a principled manner under the Constitution and not be just politicians in robes, as sometimes is pejoratively said. The definition of a disputed presidential election is there's nothing more intense. There's nothing more polarizing because nobody wants to lose and the stakes are so high. So how can we structure a mechanism in law that is fair as possible to both sides in the dispute because somebody's going to lose? And labor management arbitration gives us a model. What labor management arbitration does is the labor union designates one member of the arbitration panel. Management designates a second. So each side is equally represented. And then those two pick the third, because you have to have a potential tiebreaker if it's not going to be a unanimous decision. But the tiebreaking vote is chosen in a completely even-handed manner. That's sort of the fairest tribunal humanly possible for a contentious dispute. And we've actually seen it used in elections successfully. I mentioned the Minnesota election of 2008. There was a version of that actually used by the Minnesota judiciary because they had one Democrat on a three-judge panel, one Republican. And then because Jesse Ventura had been an independent governor, they could find a member of the judiciary that was neither Democrat nor Republican and that could be neutral. And that panel was perceived to be fair to both sides. Minnesota did another version of this back in 1962 for a governor's dispute, where again, they needed three members, but the third member was going to be strictly neutral. And so the thought is, if particularly now when the status of the Supreme Court is so controversial with the present nomination hearings going on, a way to isolate the court from that controversy is to say, for this kind of case, create this special panel, which the court has the power to do. Doesn't have to do it for other cases, just on a temporary basis. So if they created this three-person tribunal in this way, no one could complain that the system was unfair. That's the theory of it.
Do you believe the Supreme Court was wrong to step in and stop the counting in Bush v. Gore?
Yes, although there was two parts to the Supreme Court's decision. There was the equal protection holding, which was actually a 7-2 vote. And I don't think the court was wrong to find the equal protection problem in the way that Justice Souter acknowledged and Justice Breyer acknowledged, as well as the 5-member majority. Where I do think the court was wrong was stopping any further recounting. And the reason for that is they relied on this concept of the safe harbor provision, which is a promise by Congress to accept state results by a certain deadline. But it's an optional deadline on the part of the state, and the court acknowledged that. But the court didn't let the state exercise that option. The majority opinion in Bush versus Gore said, well, we already know what Florida thinks about that option, that they want to exercise it. So that must mean no more recounting. But in fact, it should have been open to Florida to take a second look at that option. There were still 6 more days between the so-called safe harbor deadline, which was when the court issued its ruling, and then the meeting of the electors in the Electoral College was 6 days later. So it should have been up to the state of Florida to say, do we want to use those 6 days to try again to do a recount without an equal protection problem? The majority opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court denied the state of Florida that second chance, and I think that was an incorrect determination.
So Would you say that if everyone gets out there and votes early, as the people of Georgia are doing today, that that will allay many of the problems you foresee or are concerned about for the 2020 election on November 3rd?
Absolutely. Voting early is a better choice for voters where it exists in state law, as Georgia has it. Whether one votes early in person when that option exists or exercises the vote by mail option at the earlier part of the process, because you protect yourself as an individual voter by acting early.
Are you going to vote by mail, or are you going to vote in person, or are you going to drop your ballot into a drop box?
I have dropped my ballot into a drop box. It was a ballot that was mailed to me, and my wife and I over the weekend took it to a designated official drop box that we have in our jurisdiction.
So, you trust that drop box to be safe?
Yes, I do. It's the government's own drop box. It's as secure as handing it to the government official, in my judgment.
Thank you so much, Professor Foley, for joining us today.
Thanks, Diane. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. That was Edward Foley. He's director of the Election Law Program at Ohio State University. He's also a contributing columnist for The Washington Post. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during this very difficult time. Do continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Benton Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I hope you'll continue to wear those masks, take care of yourself and those around you. I'm Diane Rehm.